This is Audible.
Wild at Heart by John Eldridge. This audio version is published by Oasis Audio through an agreement with Thomas Nelson Publishers. Wild at Heart is read by Kelly Ryan Dolan with a special introduction by the author.
I know. I almost want to apologize. Dear Lord, do we really need another book for men? Nope. We need something else. We need permission. Permission to be what we are, men made in God's image. Permission to live from the heart and not from the list of should and ought to that has left so many of us tired and bored. Most messages for men ultimately fail, and the reason is simple. They ignore what is deep and true to a man's heart, his real passions, and simply try to shape him up through various forms of pressure. This is the man you ought to be. This is what a good husband, father, Christian, churchgoer ought to do. Fill in the blanks from there. He is responsible, sensitive, disciplined, faithful, diligent, dutiful, on and on. Many of these are good qualities, that these messengers are well-intentioned, I have no doubt. But the road to hell, as we remember, is paved with good intentions. That they are a near total failure should seem obvious by now. No, men need something else. They need a deeper understanding of why they long for adventures and battle and a beauty, and why God made them just like that. And they need a deeper understanding of why women long to be fought for, to be swept up into an adventure, and to be the beauty, for that is how God made them as well. So I offer this book not as the seven steps to being a better Christian, but as a safari of the heart, to recover a life of freedom, passion, and adventure. I believe it will help men get their heart back, and women as well. Moreover, it will help women to understand their men and help them live the life they both want. That is my prayer for you. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who have never known neither victory nor defeat. Teddy Roosevelt. The kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and violent men take it by force. Matthew 11:12.
Chapter 1. Wild at Heart. The heart of a man is like deep water. Proverbs 20:5. The spiritual life cannot be made suburban. It is always frontier, and we who live in it must accept and even rejoice that it remains untamed. Howard Macy. I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences. I can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in. Cole Porter. At last, I am surrounded by wilderness. The wind in the top of the pines behind me sounds like the ocean. Waves are rushing in from the great blue above, cresting upon the ridge of the mountain I have climbed, somewhere in the Sawatch Range of central Colorado. Spreading out below me, the landscape is a sea of sagebrush for mile after lonesome mile. Zane Grey immortalized it as the purple sage, but most of the year, it's more of a silver gray. This is the kind of country you could ride across for days on horseback without seeing another living soul. Today, I am on foot. Though the sun is shining this afternoon, it will not warm above 30 here near the Continental Divide, and the sweat I worked up scaling this face is now making me shiver. It is late October and winter is coming on. In the distance, nearly 100 miles south by southwest, the San Juan Mountains are already covered in snow. The aroma of the pungent sage still clings to my jeans, and it clears my head as I gasp for air, in notably short supply at 10,000 feet. I am forced to rest again, even though I know that each pause broadens the distance between me and my quarry. Still, the advantage has always been his. Though the tracks I found this morning were fresh, only a few hours old, that holds little promise. A bull elk can easily cover miles of rugged country in that amount of time, especially if he is wounded or on the run. The Wapiti, as the Indians called him, is one of the most elusive creatures we have left in the lower 48. They are the ghost kings of the high country, more cautious and wary than deer, and more difficult to track. They live in higher elevations and travel further in a day than nearly any other game. The bulls especially seem to carry a sixth sense to human presence. A few times I've gotten close. The next moment they are gone, vanishing silently into aspen groves so thick you wouldn't have believed a rabbit could get through. It wasn't always this way. For centuries, elk lived out on the prairies, grazing together on the rich grasses in vast numbers. In the spring of 1805, Meriwether Lewis described passing herds lolling about in thousands as he made his way in search of a northwest passage. At times, the curious wandered so close that he could throw sticks at them, like bucolic dairy cows blocking the road. But by the end of the century, westward expansion had pushed the elk high up into the Rocky Mountains. Now they are elusive, hiding out at timberline like outlaws until heavy snows force them down for the winter. If you would seek them now, it is on their terms, in forbidding haunts well beyond the reach of civilization. And that is why I come. And why I linger here still, letting the old bull get away. My hunt, you see, actually has little to do with the elk. I knew that before I came. There is something else I am after, out here in the wild. I am searching for an even more elusive prey, something that can only be found through the help of the wilderness. I am looking for my heart. Eve was created within the lush beauty of Eden's garden, but Adam, if you'll remember, was created outside the garden, in the wilderness. In the record of our beginnings, the second chapter of Genesis makes it clear. Man was born in the outback, from the untamed part of creation. Only afterward is he brought to Eden. Ever since then, boys have never been at home indoors, and men have had an insatiable longing to explore. We long to return. It's when most men come alive. As John Muir said, when a man comes to the mountains, he comes home. The core of a man's heart is undomesticated, and that is good. I am not alive in an office, as one North Face ad has it. I am not alive in a taxi cab. I am not alive on a sidewalk. Amen to that. Their conclusion? Never stop exploring. My gender seems to need little encouragement. It comes naturally, like our innate love of maps. In 1260, Marco Polo headed off to find China, and in 1967, when I was 7, I tried to dig a hole straight through from our backyard with my friend Danny Wilson. We gave up at about 8 feet, but it made a great fort. Hannibal crossed his famous Alps, and there comes a day in a boy's life when he first crosses the street and enters the company of the great explorers. Scott and Amundsen race for the South Pole. Peary and Cook vie for the North. And when last summer I gave my boys some loose change and permission to ride their bikes down to the store to buy a soda, you'd have thought I'd given them a charter to go find the equator. Magellan sails due west, around the tip of South America, despite warnings that he and his crew will drop off the end of the earth. And Huck Finn heads down the Mississippi, ignoring similar threats. Powell follows the Colorado into the Grand Canyon, because no one has done it before, and everyone is saying it can't be done. And so my boys and I stood on the bank of the Snake River in the spring of 98, feeling the ancient urge to shove off. Snow melt was high that year, unusually high, and the river had overflowed its banks and was surging through the trees on both sides. Out in the middle of the river, which is crystal clear in late summer, but that day looked like chocolate milk, logs were floating down, large tangles of branches bigger than a car, and who knows what else. High and muddy and fast, the snake was forbidding. No other rafters could be seen. Did I mention it was raining? But we had a brand new canoe and the paddles were in hand, and sure, I've never floated the snake in a canoe, nor any other river for that matter, but what the heck? We jumped in and headed off into the unknown, like Livingstone plunging into the interior of dark Africa. Adventure, with all its requisite danger and wildness, is a deeply spiritual longing written into the soul of man. The masculine heart needs a place where nothing is prefabricated, modular, non-fat, Ziploc, franchised, online, microwavable. Where there are no deadlines, cell phones, or committee meetings. Where there is room for the soul. Where finally, the geography around us corresponds to the geography of our heart. Look at the heroes of the biblical text. Moses does not encounter the living God at the mall. He finds him, or is found by him, somewhere out in the deserts of Sinai, a long way from the comforts of Egypt. The same is true of Jacob, who has his wrestling match with God not on the living room sofa, but in a wadi somewhere east of the Jabbok, in Mesopotamia. Where did the great prophet Elijah go to recover his strength? To the wild. As did John the Baptist and his cousin, Jesus, who was led by the Spirit into the wilderness. Whatever else those explorers were after, they were also searching for themselves. Deep in a man's heart are some fundamental questions that simply cannot be answered at the kitchen table. Who am I? What am I made of? What am I destined for? It is fear that keeps a man at home where things are neat and orderly and under his control. But the answers to his deepest questions are not to be found on television or in the refrigerator. Out there on the burning desert sands, lost in a trackless waste, Moses received his life's mission and purpose. He is called out, called up into something much bigger than he ever imagined, much more serious than CEO or Prince of Egypt. Under foreign stars, in the dead of night, Jacob received a new name, his real name. No longer is he a shrewd business negotiator, but now he is one who wrestles with God. The wilderness trial of Christ is, at its core, a test of his identity. If you are who you think you are. If a man is ever to find out who he is and what he's here for, he has got to take that journey for himself. He has got to get his heart back. The way a man's life unfolds nowadays tends to drive his heart into remote regions of the soul. Endless hours at a computer screen, selling shoes at the mall, meetings, memos, phone calls. The business world, where the majority of American men live and die, requires a man to be efficient and punctual. Corporate policies and procedures are designed with one aim, to harness a man to the plow and make him produce. But the soul refuses to be harnessed. It knows nothing of day timers and deadlines and P&L statements. The soul longs for passion, for freedom, for life. As D.H. Lawrence said, "I am not a mechanism." A man needs to feel the rhythms of the earth. He needs to have in hand something real, the tiller of a boat, a set of reins, the roughness of rope, or simply a shovel. Can a man live all his days to keep his fingernails clean and trim? Is that what a boy dreams of? Society at large can't make up its mind about men. Having spent the last 30 years redefining masculinity into something more sensitive, safe, manageable, and, well, feminine, it now berates men for not being men. Boys will be boys, they sigh. As though if a man were to truly grow up, he would forsake wilderness and wanderlust and settle down, be at home forever in Aunt Polly's parlor. Where are all the real men? Is regular fare for talk shows and new books? You ask them to be women, I want to say. The result is a gender confusion never experienced at such a wide level in the history of the world. How can a man know he is one when his highest aim is minding his manners? And then, alas, there is the church. Christianity, as it currently exists, has done some terrible things to men. When all is said and done, I think most men in the church believe that God put them on the earth to be a good boy. The problem with men, we are told, is that they don't know how to keep their promises, be spiritual leaders, talk to their wives, or raise their children. But if they will try real hard, they can reach the lofty summit of becoming a nice guy. That's what we hold up as models of Christian maturity. Really nice guys. We don't smoke, drink, or swear. That's what makes us men. Now let me ask my male readers. In all your boyhood dreams growing up, did you ever dream of becoming a nice guy? Ladies, Was the prince of your dreams dashing or merely nice? Really now, do I overstate my case? Walk into most churches in America, have a look around, and ask yourself this question. What is a Christian man? Don't listen to what is said. Look at what you find there. There is no doubt about it. You'd have to admit that a Christian man is bored. At a recent church retreat, I was talking with a guy in his 50s, listening really, about his own journey as a man. I've pretty much tried for the last 20 years to be a good man as the church defines it. Intrigued, I asked him to say what he thought that was. He paused for a long moment. Dutiful, he said, and separated from his heart. A perfect description, I thought. Sadly, right on the mark. As Robert Bly laments in Iron John, some women want a passive man if they want a man at all. The church wants a tamed man. They are called priests. The university wants a domesticated man. They are called tenure-track people. The corporation wants a sanitized, hairless, shallow man. It all comes together as a sort of westward expansion against the masculine soul. And thus the heart of man is driven into the high country, into remote places, like a wounded animal looking for cover. Women know this and lament that they have no access to their man's heart. Men know it too, but are often unable to explain why their heart is missing. They know their heart is on the run, but they often do not know where to pick up the trail. The church wags its head and wonders why it can't get more men to sign up for its programs. The answer is simply this. We have not invited a man to know and live from his deep heart. But God made the masculine heart, set it within every man, and thereby offers him an invitation. Come and live out what I meant you to be. Permit me to bypass the entire nature versus nurture, is gender really built in debate with one simple observation. Men and women are made in the image of God, as men or as women. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. Genesis 1:27. Now, we know God doesn't have a body, so the uniqueness can't be physical. Gender simply must be at the level of the soul, in the deep and everlasting places within us. God doesn't make generic people. He makes something very distinct. A man or a woman. In other words, there is a masculine heart and a feminine heart, which in their own ways reflect or portray to the world God's heart. God meant something when he meant man, and if we are to ever find ourselves, we must find that. What has he set in the masculine heart? Instead of asking you what you think you ought to do to become a better man, or woman for my female readers, I want to ask, what makes you come alive? What stirs your heart? The journey we face now is into a land foreign to most of us. We must head into country that has no clear trail. This charter for exploration takes us into our own hearts, into our deepest desires. As the playwright Christopher Fry says, "Life is a hypocrite if I can't live the way it moves me." There are three desires I find written so deeply into my heart, I know now I can no longer disregard them without losing my soul. They are core to who and what I am and yearn to be. I gaze into boyhood. I search the pages of literature. I listen carefully to many, many men, and I am convinced these desires are universal, a clue into masculinity itself. They may be misplaced, forgotten, or misdirected, but in the heart of every man is a desperate desire for a battle to fight, an adventure to live, and a beauty to rescue. I want you to think of the films men love and things they do with their free time, and especially the aspirations of little boys, and see if I am not right on this. There's a photo on my wall of a little boy about 5 years old with a crew cut, big cheeks, and an impish grin. It's an old photograph, and the color is fading, but the image is timeless. It's Christmas morning, 1964. And I've just opened what may have been the best present any boy received on any Christmas ever. A set of two pearl-handed six-shooters, complete with black leather holsters, a red cowboy shirt with two wild Mustangs embroidered on either breast, shiny black boots, red bandana, and a straw hat. I've donned the outfit and won't take it off for weeks because, you see, this is not a costume at all. It's an identity. Sure, one pant leg is tucked into my boot and the other is hanging out, but that only adds to my fresh-off-the-trail persona. My thumbs are tucked inside my gun belt, and my chest is out, because I am armed and dangerous. Bad guys, beware. This town's not big enough for the both of us. Capes and swords, camouflage, bandanas and six-shooters, these are the uniforms of boyhood. Little boys yearn to know they are powerful, they are dangerous, they are someone to be reckoned with. How many parents have tried in vain to prevent little Timmy from playing with guns? Give it up. If you do not supply a boy with weapons, he will make them from whatever materials are at hand. My boys chew their graham crackers into the shape of handguns at the breakfast table. Every stick or fallen branch is a spear, or better, a bazooka. Despite what many modern educators would say, this is not a psychological disturbance brought on by violent television or chemical imbalance. Aggression is part of the masculine design. We are hardwired for it. If we believe that man is made in the image of God, then we would do well to remember that the Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. Exodus 15:3. Little girls do not invent games where large numbers of people die, where bloodshed is a prerequisite for having fun. Hockey, for example, was not a feminine creation, nor was boxing. A boy wants to attack something, and so does a man, even if it's only a little white ball on a tee. He wants to whack it into kingdom come. On the other hand, my boys do not sit down to tea parties. They do not call their friends on the phone to talk about relationships. They grow bored of games that have no element of danger or competition or bloodshed. Cooperative games based on relational interdependence are complete nonsense. No one is killed, they ask, incredulous. No one wins? What's the point? The universal nature of this ought to have convinced us by now. The boy is a warrior. The boy is his name. And those are not boyish antics he is doing. When boys play at war, they are rehearsing their part in a much bigger drama. One day, you just might need that boy to defend you. Those Union soldiers who charged the stone walls at Bloody Angle, the Allied troops that hit the beaches at Normandy or the sands of Iwo Jima, what would they have done without this deep part of their heart? Life needs a man to be fierce and fiercely devoted. The wounds he will take throughout his life will cause him to lose heart if all he has been trained to be is soft. This is especially true in the murky waters of relationships where a man feels least prepared to advance. As Bly says, in every relationship, something fierce is needed once in a while. Now, this longing may have submerged from years of neglect, and a man may not feel that he is up to the battles he knows await him. Or it may have taken a very dark turn, as it has with inner-city gangs. But the desire is there. Every man wants to play the hero. Every man needs to know that he is powerful. Women didn't make Braveheart one of the best-selling films of the decade. Flying Tigers, The Bridge on the River Kwai, The Magnificent Seven, Shane, High Noon, Saving Private Ryan, Top Gun, the Die Hard films, Gladiator. The movies a man loves reveal what his heart longs for, what is set inside of him from the day of his birth. Like it or not, there is something fierce in the heart of every man. My mother loves to go to Europe on her vacations. We were talking about our love of the West, a friend and I, and why he moved out here from the East Coast. And that's okay for her, I guess. There's a lot of culture there. But I need wildness. Our conversation was stirred by the film Legends of the Fall, the story of three young men coming of age in the early 1900s on their father's ranch in Montana. Alfred, the eldest, is practical, pragmatic, cautious. He heads off to the big city to become a businessman, and eventually, a politician. Yet something inside him dies. He becomes a hollow man. Samuel, the youngest, is still a boy in many ways, a tender child, literate, sensitive, timid. He is killed early in the film, and we know he was not ready for battle. Then there is Tristan, the middle son. He is wild at heart. It is Tristan who embodies the West. He catches and breaks the wild stallion, fights the grizzly with a knife, and wins the beautiful woman. I have yet to meet a man who wants to be Alfred or Samuel. I have yet to meet a woman who wants to marry one. There's a reason the American cowboy has taken on mythic proportions. He embodies a yearning every man knows from very young, to go West. To find a place where he can be all he knows he was meant to be. To borrow Walter Brueggemann's description of God, wild, dangerous, unfettered, and free. Now, let me stop for a moment and make something clear. I am no great white hunter. I have no dead animals adorning the walls of my house. I didn't play college football. In fact, in college, I weighed 135 pounds and wasn't much of an athlete. Despite my childhood dreams, I have never been a race car driver or a fighter pilot. I have no interest in televised sports. I don't like cheap beer. And though I do drive an old Jeep, its tires are not ridiculously large. I say this because I anticipate that many listeners, good men and women, will be tempted to dismiss this as some sort of macho man pep rally. Not at all. I am simply searching, as many men and hopeful women are, for an authentic masculinity. When winter fails to provide an adequate snow base, my boys bring their sleds in the house and ride them down the stairs. Just the other day, my wife found them with a rope out their second-story bedroom window, prepared to rappel down the side of the house. The recipe for fun is pretty simple, raising boys. Add to any activity an element of danger, stir in a little exploration, add a dash of destruction, and you've got yourself a winner. The way they ski is a perfect example. Get to the top of the highest run, point your skis straight downhill, and go. The faster the better. And this doesn't end with age. The stakes simply get higher. A judge in his 60s, a real southern gentleman with a pinstriped suit and an elegant manner of speech, pulled me aside during a conference. Quietly, almost apologetically, he spoke of his love for sailing, for the open sea, and how he and a buddy eventually built their own boat. Then came a twinkle in his eye. We were sailing off the coast of Bermuda a few years ago, when we were hit by a northeaster. Really, it came up out of nowhere. 20-foot swells in a 30-foot homemade boat. I thought we were all going to die. A pause for dramatic effect. And then he confessed. It was the best time of my life. Compare your experience watching the latest James Bond or Indiana Jones thriller with, say, going to a Bible study. The guaranteed success of each new release makes it clear. Adventure is written into the heart of a man. And it's not just about having fun. Adventure requires something of us, puts us to the test. Though we may fear the test, at the same time we yearn to be tested, to discover that we have what it takes. That's why we set off down the Snake River against all sound judgment. Why a buddy and I pressed on through grizzly country to find good fishing. Why I went off to Washington, D.C. as a young man to see if I could make it in those shark-infested waters. If a man has lost this desire, says he doesn't want it, that's only because he doesn't know he has what it takes, believes that he will fail the test. And so he decides it's better not to try. For reasons I hope to make clear later, most men hate the unknown and, like Cain, want to settle down and build their own city, get on top of their life. But you can't escape it. There is something wild in the heart of every man. Romeo has his Juliet. King Arthur fights for Guinevere. Robin rescues Maid Marian. And I will never forget the time I kissed my grade school sweetheart. It was the fall of my 7th grade year. I met Debbie in drama class and fell absolutely head over heels. It was classic puppy love. I'd wait for her after rehearsals were over, carry her books back to her locker. We passed notes in class, talked on the phone at night. I had never paid girls much attention, really, until now. This desire awakens a bit later in a boy's journey to manhood. But when it does, his universe turns on its head. Anyway, I longed to kiss her, but just couldn't work up the courage until the last night of the school play. The next day was summer vacation, she was going away, and I knew it was now or never. Backstage, in the dark, I slipped her a quick kiss, and she returned a longer one. Do you remember the scene from the movie E.T., where the boy flies across the moon on his bike? Though I rode my little Schwinn home that night, I'm certain I never touched the ground. There is nothing so inspiring to a man as a beautiful woman. She'll make you want to charge the castle, slay the giant, leap across the parapets, or maybe hit a home run. One day during a little league game, my son Samuel was so inspired. He likes baseball, but most boys starting out aren't sure they really have it in them to be a great player. Sam's our firstborn, and like so many firstborns, he is cautious. He always lets a few pitches go by before he takes a swing, and when he does, it's never a full swing. Every one of his hits up to this point were in the infield. Anyway, just as Sam steps up to bat this one afternoon, his friend from down the street, a cute little blonde girl, shows up along the first base line. Standing on tiptoe, she yells out his name and waves to Sam. pretending he doesn't notice her. He broadens his stance, grips the bat a little tighter, looks at the pitcher with something fierce in his eye. First one over the plate, he knocks into center field. A man wants to be the hero to the beauty. Young men going off to war carry a photo of their sweetheart in their wallet. Men who fly combat missions will paint a beauty on the side of their aircraft. The crews of the World War II B-17 bomber gave those flying fortresses names like Me and My Gal or the Memphis Belle. What would Robin Hood or King Arthur be without the woman they love? Lonely men fighting lonely battles. Indiana Jones and James Bond just wouldn't be the same without a beauty at their side, and inevitably, they must fight for her. You see, it's not just that a man needs a battle to fight. He needs someone to fight for. Remember Nehemiah's words to the few brave souls defending a wall-less Jerusalem? Don't be afraid. Fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. The battle itself is never enough. A man yearns for romance. It's not enough to be a hero. It's that he is a hero to someone in particular, to the woman he loves. Adam was given the wind and the sea, the horse and the hawk, but as God himself said, things were just not right until there was Eve. Yes, there is something passionate in the heart of every man. There are also three desires that I have found essential to a woman's heart, which are not entirely different from a man's, and yet they remain distinctly feminine. Not every woman wants a battle to fight, but every woman yearns to be fought for. Listen to the longing of a woman's heart. She wants to be more than noticed. She wants to be wanted. She wants to be pursued. I just want to be a priority to someone, a friend in her 30s told me. And her childhood dreams of a knight in shining armor coming to her rescue are not girlish fantasies. They are the core of the feminine heart and the life she knows she was made for. So Zach comes back for Paula in An Officer and a Gentleman. Frederick comes back for Joe in Little Women. And Edward returns to pledge his undying love for Eleanor in Sense and Sensibility. Every woman also wants an adventure to share. One of my wife's favorite films is The Man from Snowy River. She loves the scene where Jessica, the beautiful young heroine, is rescued by Jim, her hero, and together they ride on horseback through the wilds of the Australian wilderness. I want to be Isabeau and Lady Hawk, confessed another female friend. To be cherished, pursued, fought for, yes, but also I want to be strong and a part of the adventure. So many men make the mistake of thinking that the woman is the adventure. But that is where the relationship immediately goes downhill. A woman doesn't want to be the adventure. She wants to be caught up into something greater than herself. Our friend went on to say, I know myself and I know I'm not the adventure. So when a man makes me the point, I grow bored immediately. I know that story. Take me into one I don't know. And finally, every woman wants to have a beauty to unveil. Not to conjure, but to unveil. Most women feel the pressure to be beautiful from very young, but that is not what I speak of. There is also a deep desire to simply and truly be the beauty and be delighted in. Most little girls will remember playing dress-up or wedding day or twirling skirts, those flowing dresses that were perfect for spinning around in. She'll put her pretty dress on, come into the living room and twirl. What she longs for is to capture her daddy's delight. My wife remembers standing on top of the coffee table as a girl of 5 or 6 and singing her heart out. Do you see me? Asks the heart of every girl. And are you captivated by what you see? The world kills a woman's heart when it tells her to be tough, efficient, and independent. Sadly, Christianity has missed her heart as well. Walk into most churches in America, have a look around, and ask yourself this question. What is a Christian woman? Again, don't listen to what is said. Look at what you find there. There's no doubt about it. You'd have to admit that a Christian woman is tired. All we've offered the feminine soul is pressure to be a good servant. No one is fighting for her heart. There is no grand adventure to be swept up in. And every woman doubts very much that she has any beauty to unveil. Which would you rather be said of you? Harry? Sure, I know him. He's a real sweet guy. Or, yes, I know about Harry. He's a dangerous man, in a really good way. Ladies, how about you? Which man would you rather have as your mate? Some women, hurt by masculinity gone bad, might argue for the safe man, and then wonder why, years later, there is no passion in their marriage, why he is distant and cold. And as for your own femininity, what would you rather have said of you? That you are a tireless worker, or that you are a captivating woman? I rest my case. What if? What if those deep desires in our hearts are telling us the truth, revealing to us the life we were meant to live? God gave us eyes so that we might see. He gave us ears that we might hear. He gave us wills that we might choose. And He gave us hearts that we might live. The way we handle the heart is everything. A man must know he is powerful. He must know he has what it takes. A woman must know she is beautiful. She must know she is worth fighting for. "But you don't understand," said one woman to me. "I'm living with a hollow man." No, it's in there. His heart is there. It may have evaded you like a wounded animal, always out of reach, one step beyond your catching, but it's there. "I don't know when I died," said another man, "but I feel like I'm just using up oxygen." I understand. Your heart may feel dead and gone, but it's there. Something wild and strong and valiant, just waiting to be released. And so, this is not a book about the 7 things a man ought to do to be a nicer guy. It is a book about the recovery and release of a man's heart, his passions, his true nature, which he was given by God. It's an invitation to rush the fields at Bannockburn, to go west, to leap from the falls and save the beauty. For if you are going to know who you truly are as a man, if you are going to find a life worth living, if you are going to love a woman deeply and not pass on your confusion to your children, you simply must get your heart back. You must head up into the high country of the soul, into wild and uncharted regions, and track down that elusive prey. Chapter 2. The Wild One Whose Image We Bear. How would telling people to be nice to one another get a man crucified? What government would execute Mr. Rogers or Captain Kangaroo? Philip Yancey. Safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. C.S. Lewis. This is a stem of that victorious stock, and let us fear the native mightiness and fate of him. Henry V. Remember that little guy I told you about, with the shiny boots and a pair of 6-shooters? The best part of the story is that it wasn't all pretend. I had a place to live out those dreams. My grandfather, my father's father, was a cowboy. He worked his own cattle ranch in eastern Oregon, between the Desert Sage and the Snake River. And though I was raised in the suburbs, the redemption of my life and the real training grounds for my own masculine journey took place on that ranch, where I spent my boyhood summers. Oh, that every boy should be so lucky. To have your days filled with tractors and pickup trucks, horses and roping steers, running through the fields, fishing in the ponds. I was Huck Finn for 3 wonderful months every year. How I loved it when my grandfather, Pop is what I called him, would look at me, his thumbs tucked in his belt, smile, and say, "Saddle up." One afternoon, Pop took me into town, to my favorite store. It was a combination feed and tack hardware ranch supply shop, the classic dry goods store of the Old West, a wonderland of tools and equipment, saddles, bridles and blankets, fishing gear, pocket knives, rifles. It smelled of hay and linseed oil, of leather and gunpowder and kerosene. All the things that thrill a boy's heart. That summer, Pop was having a problem with an overrun pigeon population on the ranch. He hated the dirty birds, feared they were carrying diseases to the cattle. Flying rats is what he called them. Pop walked straight over to the firearms counter, picked out a BB rifle and a quart-sized milk carton with about 1 million BBs in it, and handed them to me. The old shopkeeper looked a bit surprised as he stared down at me, squinting over his glasses. "Isn't he a bit young for that?" Pop put his hand on my shoulder and smiled. "This is my grandson, Hal. He's riding shotgun for me." I may have walked into that feed store a squirrely little kid, but I walked out as Sheriff Wyatt Earp, the Lone Ranger, Kit Carson. I had an identity and a place in the story. I was invited to be dangerous. If a boy is to become a man, if a man is to know he is one, this is not an option. A man has to know where he comes from and what he's made of. One of the turning points in my good friend Craig's life, maybe the turning point, was the day he took back his father's name. Craig's father, Al McConnell, was killed in the Korean War when Craig was only 4 months old. His mother remarried, and Craig was adopted by his stepdad, a sour old Navy captain who would call Craig a seagull whenever he was angry with him. Talk about an identity, a place in the story. He'd say, "Craig, you're nothing but a seagull. All you're good for is sitting, squawking, and..." You get the idea. When Craig was a man, he learned the truth of his heritage, how his dad was a warrior who had been cut down in battle, how if he had lived, he was planning on going to the mission field to take the gospel to a place no one had ever gone before. Craig discovered that his real great-grandfather was William McConnell, the first missionary to Central America, a man who risked his life many times to bring Christ to a lost people. Craig changed his name to McConnell, and with it, took back a much more noble identity, a much more dangerous place in the story. Would that we were all so fortunate. Many men are ashamed of their fathers. "You're just like your father," is an arrow many a bitter mother fires at her son. Most of the men I know are trying hard not to become like their fathers. But who does that leave them to follow after? From whom will they derive their sense of strength? Maybe it would be better to turn our search to the headwaters, to that mighty root from which these branches grow. Who is this one we allegedly come from, whose image every man bears? What is he like? In a man's search for his strength, telling him that he's made in the image of God may not sound like a whole lot of encouragement at first. To most men, God is either distant or he is weak, the very thing they'd report of their earthly fathers. Be honest now, what is your image of Jesus as a man? "Isn't he sort of meek and mild?" a friend remarked. "I mean, the pictures I have of him show a gentle guy with children all around, kind of like Mother Teresa." Yes, those are the pictures I've seen myself in many churches. In fact, those are the only pictures I've seen of Jesus. As I've said before, they leave me with the impression that he was the world's nicest guy, Mr. Rogers with a beard. Telling me to be like him feels like telling me to go limp and passive. Be nice, be swell. Be like Mother Teresa. I'd much rather be told to be like William Wallace. Wallace, if you'll recall, is the hero of the film Braveheart. He is the warrior poet who came as the liberator of Scotland in the early 1300s. When Wallace arrives on the scene, Scotland has been under the iron fist of English monarchs for centuries. The latest king is the worst of them all, Edward the Longshanks. A ruthless oppressor, Longshanks has devastated Scotland, killing her sons and raping her daughters. The Scottish nobles, supposed protectors of their flock, have instead piled heavy burdens on the backs of the people while they line their own purses by cutting deals with Longshanks. Wallace is the first to defy the English oppressors. Outraged, Longshanks sends his armies to the field of Stirling to crush the rebellion. The Highlanders come down in groups of hundreds and thousands. It's time for a showdown. But the nobles, cowards all, don't want to fight. They want a treaty with England that will buy them more lands and power. They are typical Pharisees, bureaucrats, religious administrators. Without a leader to follow, the Scots begin to lose heart. One by one, then in larger numbers, they start to flee. At that moment, Wallace rides in with his band of warriors, blue war paint on their faces, ready for battle. Ignoring the nobles, who have gone to parley with the English captains to get another deal, Wallace goes straight for the hearts of the fearful Scots. "Sons of Scotland, you have come to fight as free men, and free men you are." He gives them an identity and a reason to fight. He reminds them that a life lived in fear is no life at all, that every last one of them will die someday. "And dying in your beds many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?" He tells them they have what it takes. At the end of his stirring speech, the men are cheering. They are ready. Then Wallace's friend asks, "Fine speech. Now what do we do?" "Just be yourselves." "Where are you going?" "I'm going to pick a fight." Finally, someone is going to stand up to the English tyrants. While the nobles jockey for position, Wallace rides out and interrupts the parley. He picks a fight with the English overlords, and the Battle of Stirling ensues, a battle that begins the liberation of Scotland. Now, is Jesus more like Mother Teresa or William Wallace? The answer is, it depends. If you're a leper, an outcast, a pariah of society whom no one has ever touched because you are unclean, if all you have ever longed for is just one kind word, then Christ is the incarnation of tender mercy. He reaches out and touches you. On the other hand, if you're a Pharisee, one of those self-appointed doctrine police, watch out. On more than one occasion, Jesus picks a fight with those notorious hypocrites. Take the story of the crippled woman in Luke 13. Here's the background. The Pharisees are like the Scottish nobles. They, too, load heavy burdens on the backs of God's people, but do not lift a finger to help them. What is more, they are so bound to the law that they insist it is a sin to heal someone on the Sabbath, for that would be doing work. They have twisted God's intentions so badly that they think that man was made for the Sabbath rather than the Sabbath for men. Christ has already had a number of skirmishes with them, some over this very issue, leaving those quislings wild with rage. Does Jesus tiptoe around the issue next time so as not to rock the boat, the preference of so many leaders today? Does he drop the subject in order to preserve church unity? Nope. He walks right into it. He baits them. He picks a fight. Let's pick up the story there. One Sabbath day, as Jesus was teaching in a synagogue, he saw a woman who had been crippled by an evil spirit. She had been bent double for 18 years and was unable to stand up straight. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, "Woman, you are healed of your sickness." Then he touched her, and instantly she could stand straight. How she praised and thanked God. But the leader in charge of the synagogue was indignant that Jesus had healed her on the Sabbath day. "There are 6 days of the week for working," he said to the crowd. "Come on those days to be healed, not on the Sabbath." Can you believe this guy? What a weasel. Talk about completely missing the point. Christ is furious. But the Lord replied, "You hypocrite, you work on the Sabbath day. Don't you untie your ox or your donkey from their stalls on the Sabbath and lead them out for water? Wasn't it necessary for me, even on the Sabbath day, to free this dear woman from the bondage in which Satan has held her for 18 years? This shamed his enemies, and all the people rejoiced at the wonderful things he did. Christ draws the enemy out, exposes him for what he is, and shames him in front of everyone. The Lord is a gentleman? Not if you're in the service of his enemy. God has a battle to fight, and the battle is for our freedom. As Tremper Longman says, virtually every book of the Bible, Old and New Testaments, and almost every page tells us about God's warring activity. I wonder if the Egyptians who kept Israel under the whip would describe Yahweh as a really nice guy. Plagues, pestilence, the death of every firstborn. That doesn't seem very gentlemanly now, does it? What would Miss Manners have to say about taking the promised land? Does wholesale slaughter fit under calling on your new neighbors? You remember that wild man, Samson? He's got a pretty impressive masculine resume. Killed a lion with his bare hands, pummeled and stripped 30 Philistines when they used his wife against him. And finally, after they burned her to death, he killed 1,000 men with the jawbone of a donkey. Not a guy to mess with. But did you notice? All those events happened when the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. Judges 15:14. Now, let me make one thing clear. I am not advocating a sort of macho man image. I'm not suggesting we all head off to the gym and then to the beach to kick sand in the faces of wimpy Pharisees. I am attempting to rescue us from a very, very mistaken image we have of God, especially of Jesus, and therefore of men as his image bearers. Dorothy Sayers wrote that the church has very efficiently pared the claws of the Lion of Judah, making him a fitting household pet for pale curates and pious old ladies. Is that the God you find in the Bible? To Job, who has questioned God's strength, he replies, "Do you give the horse his strength or clothe his neck with a flowing mane? Do you make him leap like a locust, striking terror with his proud snorting? He paws fiercely, rejoicing in his strength, and charges into the fray. He laughs at fear, afraid of nothing. He does not shy away from the sword. The quiver rattles against his side, along with the flashing spear and lance. In frenzied excitement, he eats up the ground. He cannot stand still when the trumpet sounds. At the blast of the trumpet, he snorts, aha! He catches the scent of battle from afar, the shout of commanders and the battle cry." Job 39, 19 through 25. The war horse, the stallion, embodies the fierce heart of his maker. And so do we. Every man is a stem of that victorious stock. Or at least, he was originally. You can tell what kind of a man you've got simply by noting the impact he has on you. Does he make you bored? Does he scare you with his doctrinal Nazism? Does he make you want to scream because he's just so very nice? In the Garden of Gethsemane, in the dead of night, a mob of thugs carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons comes to take Christ away. Note the cowardice of it. Why didn't they take him during the light of day, down in the town? Does Jesus shrink back in fear? No, he goes to face them head on. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said, and Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Again he asked them, "Who is it you want?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." "I told you that I am he," Jesus answered. "If you were looking for me, then let these men go." John 18:4-8. Talk about strength. The sheer force of Jesus' bold presence knocks the whole posse over. A few years ago, a good man gave me a copy of a poem Ezra Pound wrote about Christ called Ballad of the Goodly Fair. It's become my favorite. Written from the perspective of one of the men who followed Christ, perhaps Simon the Zealot, it'll make a lot more sense if you know that fair is an old English word that means mate or companion. "Ha, we lost the goodliest fair of all, for the priests and the gallows tree. Aye lover he was of brawny men, O ships and the open sea. When they came with a host to take our man, his smile was good to see. First let these go, quo our goodly fair, or I'll see ye damned," says he. "Aye he sent us out through the crossed high spears, and the scorn of his laugh rang free. Why took ye me not when I walked about, alone in the town," says he. "Oh, we drunk his hail in the good red wine, when we last made company. No capon priest was the goodly fair, but a man o' men was he. I have seen him drive 100 men, with a bundle of cords swung free, that they took the high and holy house, for their pawn and treasury. I have seen him cow 1,000 men, on the hills of Galilee. They whined as he walked out calm between, with his eyes like the gray o' the sea. Like the sea that brooks no voyaging, with the winds unleashed and free. Like the sea that he cowed at Genseret, with 2 words spoke suddenly. A master of men was the goodly fair, a maid of the wind and sea. If they think they have slain our goodly fair, they are fools eternally." Jesus is no capon priest, no pale-faced altar boy with his hair parted in the middle, speaking softly, avoiding confrontation, who at last gets himself killed because he has no way out. He works with wood, commands the loyalty of dock workers. He is the Lord of hosts, the captain of angel armies. And when Christ returns, he is at the head of a dreadful company, mounted on a white horse with a double-edged sword, his robe dipped in blood. Revelation 19. Now that sounds a lot more like William Wallace than it does Mother Teresa. No question about it, there is something fierce in the heart of God. If you have any doubts as to whether or not God loves wildness, spend a night in the woods, alone. Take a walk out in a thunderstorm. Go for a swim with a pod of killer whales. Get a bull moose mad at you. Whose idea was this anyway? The Great Barrier Reef with its great white sharks, the jungles of India with their tigers, the deserts of the Southwest with all those rattlesnakes. Would you describe them as nice places? Most of the earth is not safe, but it's good. That struck me a little too late when hiking in to find the Upper Kenai River in Alaska. My buddy Craig and I were after the salmon and giant rainbow trout that live in those icy waters. We were warned about bears, but didn't really take it seriously until we were deep into the woods. Grizzly sign was everywhere. Salmon strewn about the trail, their heads bitten off. Piles of droppings the size of small dogs. Huge claw marks on the trees, about head level. We're dead, I thought. What are we doing out here? And then it occurred to me that after God made all this, he pronounced it good, for heaven's sake. It's His way of letting us know He rather prefers adventure, danger, risk, the element of surprise. This whole creation is unapologetically wild. God loves it that way. But what about His own life? We know He has a battle to fight, but does God have an adventure to live? I mean, He already knows everything that's going to happen, right? How could there be any risk to His life? Hasn't He got everything under absolute control? In an attempt to secure the sovereignty of God, theologians have overstated their case and left us with a chess player God playing both sides of the board, making all His moves and all ours too. But clearly, this is not so. God is a person who takes immense risks. No doubt the biggest risk of all was when He gave angels and men free will, including freedom to reject Him. Not just once, but every single day. Does God cause a person to sin? Absolutely not, says Paul. Then He can't be moving all the pieces on the board because people sin all the time. Fallen angels and men use their powers to commit horrendous daily evil. Does God stop every bullet fired at an innocent victim? Does He prevent teenage liaisons from producing teenage pregnancies? There is something much more risky going on here than we're often willing to admit. Most of us do everything we can to reduce the element of risk in our lives. We wear our seat belts, watch our cholesterol, and practice birth control. I know some couples who have decided against having children altogether. They simply aren't willing to chance the heartache children often bring. What if they are born with a crippling disease? What if they turn their backs on us and God? What if? God seems to fly in the face of all caution. Even though He knew what would happen, what heartbreak and suffering and devastation would follow upon our disobedience, God chose to have children. And unlike some hyper-controlling parents who take away every element of choice they can from their children, God gave us a remarkable choice. He did not make Adam and Eve obey Him. He took a risk, a staggering risk, with staggering consequences. He let others into His story, and He lets their choices shape it profoundly. This is the world He has made. This is the world that is still going on. And He doesn't walk away from the mess we've made of it. Now He lives, almost cheerfully, certainly heroically, in a dynamic relationship with us and with our world. Then the Lord intervened is perhaps the single most common phrase about Him in Scripture, in one form or another. Look at the stories He writes. There's the one where the children of Israel are pinned against the Red Sea, no way out, with Pharaoh and his army barreling down on them in murderous fury. Then God shows up. There's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who get rescued only after they're thrown into the fiery furnace. Then God shows up. He lets the mob kill Jesus, bury Him. Then He shows up. Do you know why God loves writing such incredible stories? Because He loves to come through. He loves to show us that He has what it takes. It's not the nature of God to limit His risks and cover His bases. Far from it. Most of the time, He actually lets the odds stack up against Him. Against Goliath, a seasoned soldier and trained killer, He sends a freckled-faced little shepherd kid with a slingshot. Most commanders going into battle want as many infantry as they can get. God cuts Gideon's army from 32,000 to 300. Then He equips the ragtag little band that's left with torches and watering pots. It's not just a battle or two that God takes His chances with, either. Have you thought about His handling of the gospel? God needs to get a message out to the human race, without which they will perish forever. What's the plan? First, He starts with the most unlikely group ever. A couple of prostitutes, a few fishermen with no better than a second-grade education, a tax collector. Then, He passes the ball to us. Unbelievable. God's relationship with us and with our world is just that, a relationship. As with every relationship, there's a certain amount of unpredictability and the ever-present likelihood that you'll get hurt. The ultimate risk anyone ever takes is to love. For as C.S. Lewis says, love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. But God does give it. Again and again and again, until He is literally bleeding from it all. God's willingness to risk is just astounding, far beyond what any of us would do were we in His position. Trying to reconcile God's sovereignty and man's free will has stumped the church for ages. We must humbly acknowledge that there's a great deal of mystery involved, but for those aware of the discussion, I am not advocating open theism. Nevertheless, there is definitely something wild in the heart of God. And all his wildness and all his fierceness are inseparable from his romantic heart. That theologians have missed this says more about theologians than it does about God. Music, wine, poetry, sunsets. Those were his inventions, not ours. We simply discovered what he had already thought of. Lovers and honeymooners choose places like Hawaii, the Bahamas, or Tuscany as a backdrop for their love. But whose idea was Hawaii, the Bahamas, and Tuscany? Let's bring this a little closer to home. Whose idea was it to create the human form in such a way that a kiss could be so delicious? And he didn't stop there, as only lovers know. Starting with her eyes, King Solomon is feasting on his beloved through the course of their wedding night. He loves her hair, her smile. Her lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb. And milk and honey are under her tongue. You'll notice he's working his way down. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with elegance. Your two breasts are like two fawns. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. Song of Solomon 4:4-6. And his wife responds by saying, "Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits." What kind of God would put the Song of Songs in the canon of Holy Scripture? Really now, is it conceivable that such an erotic and scandalous book would have been placed in the Bible by the Christians you know? And what a delicate, poetic touch. Two fawns. This is no pornography, but there is no way to try and explain it all as theological metaphor. That's just nonsense. In fact, God himself actually speaks in person in the songs, once in the entire book. Solomon has taken his beloved to his bedchamber, and the two are doing everything that lovers do there. God blesses it all, whispering, "Eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers," offering, as if needed, his own encouragement. And then he pulls the shades. God is a romantic at heart, and he has his own bride to fight for. He is a jealous lover, and his jealousy is for the hearts of his people and for their freedom. As Francis Frangipane so truly states, rescue is the constant pattern of God's activity. For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent. For Jerusalem's sake, I will not remain quiet, till her righteousness shines out like the dawn, her salvation like a blazing torch. As a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you. Isaiah 62:1-5. And though she committed adultery against him, though she has fallen captive to his enemy, God is willing to move heaven and earth to win her back. He will stop at nothing to set her free. Who is this coming from Edom, from Bozra, with his garments stained crimson? Who is this, robed in splendor, striding forward in the greatness of his strength? It is I, speaking in righteousness, mighty to save. Why are your garments red, like those of one treading the winepress? I have trodden the winepress alone. From the nations no one was with me. I trampled them in my anger and trod them down in my wrath. Their blood spattered my garments, and I stained all my clothing. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redemption has come. Isaiah 63:1-4. Whoa, talk about a brave heart. This is one fierce, wild, and passionate guy. I have never heard Mr. Rogers talk like that. Come to think of it, I have never heard anyone in the church talk like that either. But this is the God of heaven and earth, the Lion of Judah. And this is our true Father, the stock from which the heart of man is drawn. Strong, courageous love. As George MacDonald wrote, "Thou art my life, I the brook, thou the spring. Because thine eyes are open, I can see. Because thou art thyself, 'tis therefore I am me." From Diary of an Old Soul.